It's the morning show. I'm Shireen Seward. 1 year ago this month, the Taliban captured Kabul, capping the fall of Afghanistan's U.S.-backed government. America's longest war ended as Islamist militants that had been chased from power in 2001 were once again back in command. More than 124,000 people were airlifted from the country, but tens of thousands of Afghans who aided the U.S. effort were left behind. Join in on the consequences of the Taliban takeover and its impact on the people of Afghanistan 1 year later. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nita Crawford is the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University. She also co-directs the Costs of War Project with Brown University. Professor Crawford, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be with you.
Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. It has been more than a year since the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. What is life like in the country now under Taliban rule?
Well, after getting abysmal, it's slightly improved over the last few months. And what I mean by abysmal is that there was rampant inflation, loss of international support, meaning there was little money flowing into the country. And there was chaos because the Taliban government wasn't really governing in a systematic way. So it has gotten a little better.
Just in recent months?
Yes, I would say the last quarter.
How?
But in overall, the situation is very, very bad.
How are conditions different in the country since the American withdrawal? And what are some of the factors? You mentioned some of them. What are some of the other factors that are contributing to those issues?
Well, the first major difference is who's in charge, or actually sort of semi in charge. And what I mean by that is the governing of Afghanistan, which was tenuous at best at times under the previous government, which was backed by the U.S., is much more fractured. It's more localized. And its concentration of power now in Kandahar rather than Kabul. And that means that they're having a coherent strategy to meet the other challenges that Afghans are facing is very difficult. So what are those other challenges? I mean, the first one is lack of international support. Now, when the Taliban took over, the international community said, no, we're not going to fund you. And for the average Afghan, that has meant a dramatic decline in standard of living. Now, most of the people in Afghanistan are hungry. Many live on one meal a day. And it's extremely expensive to buy basic things. There's been inflation, dramatic inflation, up to 50%. We think inflation is bad here. It's much worse there. So that economic and humanitarian collapse is dire for the average Afghan. 97% of the people in Afghanistan are food insecure and facing famine. So the political, the humanitarian, and the economic crises are a sort of trifecta of bad. But as I say, it's getting a little bit better because international organizations like the International Rescue Committee and some smaller organizations have been in there trying to help people. And then the Afghan people themselves are pooling resources and working to make their condition better. So overall, though, I would say that it's much worse. And then we could talk about the consequences of the war. The wars, are really ongoing with ISIS, ISIS-K. Mm-hmm. And that creates a level of instability and violence, which makes the life of the average Afghan, again, not good.
We're talking about life in Afghanistan a year after the country fell to Taliban rule with Nita Crawford. She's a professor of politics and international relations with Oxford University in the UK. The Taliban is restricting girls' education. They're only allowing boys to go to school beyond sixth grade. What effect is this having on women in the country?
Well, in the long run, it means that many girls who will be go into adulthood with little prospect of entering a job market where they have the right skills. They're not being let into the job market in any case. And I think it means simmering resentment of among the young women and girls who did get an education and who have been denied an education. As I say, however, individual Afghans are working in a clandestine way, or sometimes more or less openly, though, to make sure that girls continue to be educated. But overall, the decline in political freedom, the mobility for girls and women, and the dire economic straits that all families are under make life for women in Afghanistan very bad.
As we see more women's rights being curtailed there, I'm curious how the international community is responding to that. What are you hearing?
Well, there's the rhetorical response, which is basically, that's not okay. And then that's combined with a carrot and stick approach. If you, if the Afghan government, the Taliban government, were to loosen up, I think we'd see more aid. And there's always the carrot. That's the draw. And at one point, when the government overall was about to allow girls to go back to school, a sheikh in Kandahar said no. So that's the problem. There is no way for the entire Afghan people to weigh in on this because of the concentration of power. I think that the international community has very few levers, however, other than the possible resumption of large-scale assistance.
I remember reading about all of the talks that were taking place leading up to this when Afghanistan fell to Taliban rule. And I recall that the Taliban was assuring the world that it would be a more moderate force, that the world would not see, you know, the kind of things that they feared. Has this last year shown that to be the case? I feel like there was kind of a collective eye roll that's not going to happen. But have they been more moderate?
I think that depends on specific locations. But overall, I would say no, because extrajudicial killing has occurred. That is, people are summarily killed who disagree. There's a suppression of free speech. And in most instances, you see people, if their speech is not suppressed, people are afraid and they're hiding. So no, I would say that they did not relax, and there's still quite a bit of fear in the country. There was, I think the eye rolling was appropriate. But, you know, could this have gone another way? I don't know, actually. Could the international community have kept supporting the Taliban? Would they have been, with greater international support, able to feed people? Yes. Would they have been able to open up politically? I doubt it. I think that they're too afraid.
We see things from the outside looking in, but I'm curious what it's like for the people who live there. Do you think that the people of Afghanistan expected that the Taliban would be more moderate than they had been in the past? Do you think they have been surprised by what's happened in the past year?
You know, what I understand of what Afghans are thinking and feeling is obviously at a great remove. I don't talk to the average Afghan. I just read about their conditions from afar. And I believe there's both optimism and a sense of crisis from what I understand. There's optimism that the work of non-governmental organizations and individual efforts at organizing will gradually make a difference. But, you know, it's very hard there when most people are many people are only eating one meal a day, if that.
And is that the reality? They're eating one meal a day? Poverty is that prevalent?
Yeah, 43% of Afghans are eating one meal a day. 97% are living in conditions of poverty. From what I understand, this is a huge humanitarian crisis. And it is exacerbated in some ways by the lingering effects of 20 years of war, right? And the dire economic slash humanitarian crisis is exacerbated by environmental distress. Long periods of drought, sometimes heavy rains. There was an earthquake a few months ago that caused a lot of damage, and people were not able to get in to help. So it's a very difficult situation there at a basic human level. Yes.
Nita Crawford is the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. This month marks 1 year since the Taliban regained control in Afghanistan amid the U.S. military's withdrawal from the country. Since the takeover, policy experts and military officials continue to analyze what led to the fall of the U.S.-backed government while raising questions over the legacy of the war itself. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nita Crawford is the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University. She stays with us. The Taliban taking control raised questions about what led to what appeared on the outside to be a very chaotic and rushed withdrawal from the country. Was it as chaotic as it seemed? And if so, what went wrong with the American withdrawal from Afghanistan?
Well, I think the last few weeks were certainly chaotic and rushed, especially as the United States, the partners of the United States decided not to fight. And, you know, the Afghan military decided that it would be much more dangerous. I believe they did the calculation and said, if we fight, we don't have enough ammunition. If we fight, we don't have enough food. If we fight, then the Taliban will shell us. They've got the ammunition, and many civilians will die. And basically, I think that was a smart decision, realizing that the end was a fait accompli. The problem was that throughout the 20 years of the United States occupation of Afghanistan, two things didn't occur. First of all, a really good job preparing the Afghan military. And that the reason that didn't occur is complicated, including the fact that it was extremely dangerous to join the Afghan military for the simple reason that you might be attacked if you join the military or police, and your family would suffer retaliation. And then there was a lot of corruption in the military. The second thing that went wrong was a failure to develop a strong civil society slash governance mechanism. And there were many Afghans who did an excellent job in providing their own health care and education. But overall, much of the resources that the United States spent in Afghanistan, the vast majority of it was for military force. That is, the U.S. occupation with its allies was extremely expensive. And when you compare that to the amount of money that went into, for instance, develop agriculture or education or healthcare infrastructure, it was minuscule. So in overall, the Afghan society was already weak. And there, I think we can say that the last few months were a mess. The withdrawal began first of all, with Obama, then increased dramatically with Trump, and then basically the agreement that the United States reached in the Trump year, the final year of the Trump administration, was the one that Biden implemented, and the capacity was not there, actually, to do a good job. I just don't think that a good exit was in the cards, because the fundamental reality was not strong enough to support a good exit.
As you analyze this, do you see ways that this could have gone differently? Was there a point in which something could have changed the outcome here?
Well, there are many points. So, you know, politics is both driven by sort of fundamental things like underlying economics and relationships of power, you know, military force. And it's also driven by individuals and, you know, decision-making and leadership. And the fundamentals were from the United States invasion in 2001, not well done. So for instance, the United States, when it attacked in 2001, could have left and then supported a new regime. The Taliban was on the run and they were very weak. And the United States could have supported a new regime with massive economic support and developing the capacity of the people on the ground. And I think we would have had a much stronger civil society, able to be more robust and resilient. Okay, so we didn't do that. What's another turning point? Well, I think in 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, when the United States is engaged in a conversation with the Taliban, but the Afghan government wasn't there at the negotiations, that was a mistake. So the Afghan government had no part in what was to be an end to the war. And this weakened the Afghan government. So, you know, bookending that are a lot of points when things could have gone better. Remember, the United States escalated in 2009 very dramatically with force. And again, that, you know, killed a lot of people and looked like it temporarily worked. But as the U.S. military used to say, it was like playing whack-a-mole. So the fundamental error there, I think, is thinking that you can kill your way to a peace settlement, but not recognizing, though the U.S. military does actually recognize this at times, that when you hurt civilians along the way, that's counterproductive, and you diminish the likelihood that there will be a loss of support for insurgents, and you increase the recruitment attractiveness of insurgencies. So, you know, there, you know, it's basically, it was a mess from the get-go. That's mm-hmm. what I'm saying.
Okay. We're talking about the legacy of the war in Afghanistan a year after the country fell to Taliban rule. With Nita Crawford, she is a professor of politics and international relations with Oxford University. She is the co-director of the Costs of War Project with Brown University as well. The advocacy group No One Left Behind says at least 65,000 Afghans who worked for the American government or for contractors associated with the American military still remain in the country. What is happening to them?
I think many are in hiding and are trying to get out. There are extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Some are being killed. But I don't think we really know as much as we could know about the fate of those people. Some are on their way out, and some are staying to try to create a better Afghanistan.
And that you thought to my question. I was going to say, how do we know? How do we know what's happening to those people?
Well, in a way, it's better that we don't know a whole lot, because some of them need to make their way out, however, by whatever means. You know, maybe on foot, maybe on by automobile. You know, I don't mm-hmm. know how they're getting out, and it's best we not.
Sure.
You know, I really think that if people want to get out and they are determined, if they possibly can, they will try to do so. But I also think that, you know, the economic conditions there are so difficult that it's a struggle to live, you know, each day to get food, to make sure your family has food. People are selling whatever assets they have just to eat. I doubt that they're able to gather enough cash together, absent external assistance, to make a run for it, if that's what they want to do. They may be trying to continue to lay low. I think the main story in Afghanistan now is the humanitarian, economic, and political crisis, which is ongoing. Though, as I said, it's gotten a little bit better with less inflation in recent months.
You co-directed the Cost of War Project with Brown University. Last year, the project estimated that two decades of war post 9/11 had cost the U.S. $8 trillion, killed more than 900,000 people. Very briefly, in the 30 seconds we have left, what will the legacy of the Afghanistan war be in the U.S.?
In the U.S., it's a loss of opportunity to do the things that we could have done with that those trillions of dollars. The actual cost of the Afghanistan part of that is about looking into the future with the costs of healthcare, about $3 trillion. And the Iraq part is another large chunk. But so the legacy is in caring for veterans here and this huge amount of money we could have spent doing other things.
Nita, thank you so much for this fascinating discussion.
My pleasure.
Nita Crawford, the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University, also co-director of the Costs of War Project with Brown University. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.